not Ivana. I'm not Jonty. You may have noticed. But yeah, they're away at the moment, so it's myself and Deborah hosting today. We are very lucky to have Ben with us. Ben's an associate professor at the University of Plymouth in theoretical physics, and is working on laser particle stuff and is here to talk to us about, today about that. So yeah, over to you.
Hello, everybody. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me here. Although I've been kind of associated with the Central Laser Facility for a long time, the theories I've never actually been to around before, so this is very exciting to me for me to be in this sort of place. So I'm happy to speak here today. So I'm going to talk about science goals in laser particle interaction. So this is a bit of a synergy between particle physics and high-power laser physics. And I noticed we're just sitting in the cafe. The cafe sits between the particle physics building, which is attached to the Central Laser Facility. So this is the perfect place to be giving this kind of talk. Okay, so we begin with some key concepts in strong field QED, quantum electrodynamics. That's going to be the fundamental theory that's going to describe what's happening in those interactions between charges and laser pulses. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about charge field coupling and intense electromagnetic backgrounds. So I think that's something kind of unique to laser particle physics that we haven't encountered before, so it might be interesting. And then in the second half, we'll talk a little bit about kind of measurements that you want to make at in different experiments and kind of science goals at these experiments. And then finally, talk about quantum radiation reaction. Okay, so just starting with some very basics then. So we have this scattering paradigm in particle physics of having two bunches of particles in our in state, which is well defined and understood. We collide them, and we infer from measurements of the scattered particles the physics that occur during that collision. Now, what we consider is a paradigm where we replace one of these beams of particles with an intense laser pulse. So we have a probe beam, the electrons or positrons, or it could be photons, and we have an intense laser pulse. And we can perform the same kind of scattering experiments where what we tend to measure is what's happened to the probe beam, infer from that the physics that occurred during that collision as the charges propagated through the membranes. Different to the particle physics, we don't normally tend to measure what happens to the laser pulse because we're interested in high intensities. High intensities laser pulses are highly focused, which means that the shot-to-shot reproducibility is quite low. Instead, it's mainly the probe beam that we're looking at. So slightly different, but there's some kind of similarity there. So talks about intense electromagnetic fields by saying that electromagnetic field is intense. I'm intrinsically saying that the field is coherent. So we're interested in coherent electromagnetic fields. That's quite important. So some examples are slowly varying magnetic fields. So in cavity experiments, PV mass or ELFs, we've got coherent fields. The fields inside crystals with a high degree of symmetry. Well, in that case, you've essentially got lots of Coulomb centers, but if you have a charge which is colliding with that, all those Coulomb centers in the rest frame of the charge appear as a coherent field. So for the strong field QED I'll talk about can be used to describe that kind of physics. Beam scattering, so beam scrolling at high particle energies is an example of a coherent field. And what I'll talk about mainly from this point is laser pulses. So this could be optical laser pulses or X-ray free electron lasers. Coherence implies that the average expectation value of the electric field is not zero. A counterexample would be incoherent fields like black body radiation and strong or radiating gas jets, where there's not a well-defined phase relationship between photons produced at different space-time points. So incoherent fields like this, we expect that the expected field strength averages out to zero. So I mentioned strong field QED. What do we mean by strong fields? We can come up with a QED field strength scale by taking some of the fundamental parameters from QED. So, maybe electron mass, the positron charge, speed of light, and reduced Planck's constant. Put them all together using dimensional analysis, come up with a field strength, and you get this formula here. So, this is sometimes referred to as the Schwinger limits or the crystal field. These are really bad names because, first of all, it wasn't Schwinger who first came up with this. Look at this. More than a decade before, Heisenberg and Euler were already talking about this. Secondly, it's not a limit, as you see, we can go beyond this. Crystal field is also a bad name. There's no crystal phase transition that happens here, but people use these names, so I'm going to refer to this field strength as the Schwinger limit of the crystal field. what's the kind of physics that can occur in a field of this strength? Imagine you've got a constant, a homogeneous electric field of this strength. You can work out the work done by this field over an electron sitting in this field. You just take the charge of the electron, field strength, and for the dimension of the electron, we take its constant wavelength. And the work done by a field, if we could make one that was this intense, would be the rest energy of the electron. So we expect that when we have field strengths of this order, we'll see QD effects like creation of electron positron pairs. Can we see this in nature, fields this strong? In astrophysics, it seems like we can. So this is just a plot from this review of strongly magnetized neutron stars and what magnetic field strength they have. So you can see from the top right there, the QED field strength scale, the Schrödinger limit for magnetic fields, around 10 to 13 Gauss. And we can see lots of data points beyond 10 to 13 Gauss, going up to 10 to 14, 10 to 15. This tends to be things like anomalous X-ray pulse stars or sort of gamma ray repeaters. So in nature, we can see fields which exceed the Schrödinger limit in the lab frame, albeit it's some magnetic fields, not electric. Can we see in the lab? Fortunately, with our high power lasers, we're not quite at the level where we can produce these in the lab. We're about three orders of magnitude away from the Schrödinger limits with lasers. So why are we talking about QED with lasers? Well, we use the standard trick, which is we consider colliding charges like electrons or positrons with a laser. Then in the rest frame of those charges, the field seen is Lorentz boosted, like the Lorentz gamma factor, opposite to the beta factor. So the faster the electron is that you collide with the laser, the larger the field strength in the rest frame. And this is just a nice cartoon from Jackson. This is the Coulomb field lines on an isolated charge, and this is what happens when you Lorentz boost it in the horizontal direction. You have a bunching of the field lines to indicate the enhancement of the field strength. So how do we quantify this? I'm going to introduce a parameter, chi. It's going to occur quite a lot in the talk, so spend some time defining it properly. So chi is the strong field parameter. It's just the projection of the electron momentum on the field strength tensor normalized by the rest energy and the QD field strength scale. So what does that mean physically? Well, if we choose our fields, our background field to be a plane wave, so I'm going to be interested in lasers, so it makes sense to model a laser as kind of a plane wave. Then this parameter is exactly the field seen in an electron rest frame in units of that Schrödinger limit. So we can again say, oh, what kind of physics does that occur to? Does that correspond to? We calculate the work done by this plane wave field in the rest frame of the electron, and what we get is that this is chi times mc squared. So obviously, when chi is order one, we're at the top of the QED scale, that reason we call chi strong field parameter. So getting to chi order one experiment would be great. That would be kind of state of the art in a laser particle experiment. There are suggestions for getting to much higher values of this strong field parameter. I'll just give an example. So this is a PRL a few years ago where they did a simulation of beam swirling for two spherical electron beams colliding with 125 GeV. And in the simulation, you can see here on the right, these regions of red correspond to chi being of the order of 1,000, which, as we'll see later in the talk, is a significant value. So next generation linear colliders, you could have strong QED effects on whatever process you want. Okay, so that's a little bit about what we mean by strong fields. I want to talk a little bit about the interaction between a charge and the laser. I'm going to specify for a plane wave just because it's easier to explain. So there's a little bit of theory, but hopefully it's straightforward. So this is the gate potential for the electronic background. On the right side, the only important thing is psi. So M is the electron mass, this is the polarization of the background, this is just the shape of the laser pulse. Psi is something called the intensity parameter. The more intense the laser pulse is, the higher the value of psi. So what is psi? What does it correspond to physically? So we consider a standard QD process. I picked the example of a photon colliding with a laser to produce an electron-positron pair. And we can calculate the interaction of the pair with dynamic background with the laser. For example, having one interaction with the laser represented by dashed lines, or having two interactions with the laser, n interactions, etc. We find that the amplitude scales with the size of power n. That's kind of interesting because normally in QED, n vertices scales with the standard QED coupling, the positron charge. But here, that coupling is being replaced with the laser intensity. So the more intense we make the laser, the stronger in some ways we're binding the electrons and positrons to the laser force. So actually, it looks like making more intense laser and actually changing the nature of the interaction. There are other ways to understand this parameter. If we would look at processes with n interaction with the laser, the probability scale is like this square, so it would scale with psi to the power 2n for n laser photons, or in other words, psi squared to the power n. So what is psi squared? Well, we can write it in terms of alpha QED times a three volume to do with the laser wavelength and the quantum wavelength, and a photon number density in the laser. So in a very hand wave way, the square of the intensity parameter is really find the number of interacting photons. So the more intense you make the laser, the higher the number of photons in the laser interacting with the electron at any given time. In the experiment, we can make psi of order one. Psi of order one, and then you can't truncate this perturbation series anymore. You have to include all orders of interactions between the laser and the background. And so you would have this, you have to resum this. So we refer to this as a non-perturbative interaction between the laser and the charge. So this is a prediction of field theory, which we can commit to testing experiments. So we made the comparison with gluon saturation at small field convex. The analogy is because essentially atomic intensity going higher, the number of charge characters is getting number of photons, but essentially the number of targets that the electron has when it interacts with the laser force gets larger and larger. So we to perform calculations, we have to resolve this. And so my background is as a theorist, I think most of your background is maybe an experiment or simulation. So I have one slide of theory to explain how we do the calculation. So please indulge me for that one slide. But if you have any questions, then just drop me. So how do we do this calculation for the coordinates? Well, we don't do it. We don't calculate each order and then sum it up. That's too complicated. Instead, what we do is we split our vector potential for the laser into two parts. Well, not the laser, for the left and left field into two parts. One part is the laser. It's going to be a classical field because the laser is close to being a coherent state. And the other part is the radiated field, so electron radiates photons, or maybe there's some loop effects to do with the electromagnetic field. That's the quantized part. We take the standard Lagrangian QED, so it's the three parts. This is the three fields, this electromagnetic field, this is the three fermions, and this is the interaction. And now we split it into two parts. We've got an interaction between fermions and the laser, and between the fermions and the quantized field, the radiation field. And we just rearrange this. We move the interaction of the laser into the three part of the theory. And the consequence of that is that the equation of motion that we have to solve for the electron positrons, i.e. the Dirac equation, is modified by placing the potential of the laser inside the Dirac equation. And that's the thing we have to solve for in order to include this interaction of the laser to the orders. Now, we don't have many closed form solutions of the Dirac equation in a given electromagnetic background, but one of the backgrounds that we can solve the Dirac equation for is plane wave. We're using a plane wave to have to model a laser. You might argue that focus laser isn't a plane wave. That's right. But we're going to use these solutions, we're going to perturb around them in order to describe what happens in the place. Okay. So the leading 2D process that we have is just at a single vertex. So this is an example, normally a Compton scattering. The electron comes in, collides with the laser, produces a hard photon. The double line represents the part that we're using in this solution to the Dirac equation on the plane wave. These are Volkov states, it's a Volkov electron. And if we wanted to, we could expand this double line in interactions with the laser and look at what happens with one interaction with the laser, two interactions with the laser, etc. But we don't So we can do that because, first of all, size order one, so we need all orders. And secondly, we have the all order solution, so there's no reason to be able to defund it. So this is nominal content scattering. It might seem strange that the leading order process is this throughput function. So normally in QED, a process like this is kinematically suppressed, so it can't take place. The leading order in QED is normally two vertices. Here, because you've got a laser field interacting with the electrons, or positrons, that's able to donate energy or momentum or absorb energy momentum from this interaction. So that changes the usual kinematics. So that means there's a region of phase space where this can land. So that's why the leading order process is just a single vertex. So this is nonlinear content scattering. We already saw pair creation, photon comes in, collides with the laser, produce electron positron there. Typically, people use the word nonlinear to describe these, to differentiate them from the standard QED processes because of the nonlinear interaction between the laser background and the charge. First of all, we also have at leading order absorption processes like one photon annihilation or photon absorption, but we don't tend to calculate that much, mainly because it's difficult in a laser pulse to bring an electron bond to annihilate or to absorb a photon. And the outgoing phase space is smaller for these than it is for these. So typically, these are the ones most interesting experiments. We also have signals from loop processes. So like a mass operator, in usual QED, it just contributes to the massive normalization of the electron. But now if you've got a big laser there, there's an experimental signal. So one of the signals of this this interaction, for example, is the spin of the electron as it collides with the laser, can flip in a non-radiative way. So there's no virtual photon here, so it can flip. That's something that can be measured in experiments. Polarization operator, another example of a loop process where we have an experimental signal. Here, the signal is very similar, so it's a photon interacting with a Kirchhoff electron positron pair, which is polarized by the laser, and the signal there is a change of the polarization of the photon. So you might have heard of the vacuum birefringence. That's essentially the process that they're trying to measure in experiments like PVLAS or HIBEF or ELPS. And then we have the vertex operator, which is less well studied because it's got three vertices, so it's a higher order. But in principle, we do have some signals from that as well. Okay, so that's a little bit about the background. I wanted to talk a bit about what people are looking for in experiments, so that's more accessible. So typically experiments, refer to this picture again, experiments are going to differentiate themselves by having a different source for the strong field or a different source for the power beam. So the strong field, experiments are high power laser facilities, where you have an optical focus beam, so energies of a few EV at the interaction point. X-ray free electron lasers in principle can be strong fields studies, so they have energies around KeV. Oriented crystals, so the NA63 experiment at CERN, for example, takes 200 GeV electrons from the SDS, lies them with oriented crystals, and the crystalline field there, active coherent fields. Also, Coulomb fields, so the splitting of photons in Coulomb fields or the change, the scattering of photons in Coulomb fields. It's an example. Beam strong along, we talked about as well, and so astrophysical context. So that's kind of the different strong fields that we could consider. In terms of the probe beams, doing experiments at high power laser facilities, you want to have some particle beam. Unfortunately, typically a LINAC is not co-located with a high power laser facility, so acceleration of electrons needs to happen on site. And so that's normally done by laser wake field acceleration, by gas jets. That's for an electron probe. For a photon probe, you might combine them with a target to give a brainstorm source of photons, or use a secondary weak laser to produce a quantum scattered source, or use crystal, or even thermal emission. If you've not seen that, if you've seen a laser talk before, you would have definitely seen a plot like this. Every laser podcaster has one in, which is explaining why people are interested in using lasers to produce the strong field. So on the horizontal axis, we've got the decades, and then on the vertical axis, we've got the maximum intensity produced in a laser in that decade. So obviously, lasers were invented around the 1960s. And various inventions have allowed to get to higher intensities. Higher intensities allow us to grow QED more and more in these lasers. OPCPA was the invention that led to the Nobel Prize in 2018. And this plot is actually slightly outdated now, but there'll be other data points here. So the point is that a lot of money and investment is going into high power loads facility because to be able to reach higher intensities allows to do more interesting experiments. And so I was trying to make the argument in talks like this that high power laser facilities are a great place to do fundamental physics. Okay, this is another plot, which is similar, different laser facilities by decade. The only thing I want to point out here is the most recent laser facilities around here are accessing intensities where QED is a dominant effect in experiments. So here we've got dynamics which are dominated by emission of hard photons. Here we've got avalanche type cascades, the QED cascades that produce photons, which are produced hairs that produce photons. Okay, I want to give an example of an all optical experiment before I talk about the particle physics side of things. I realized being here, I should really have talked about Gemini, since that it's not very far away, but when I made the slides, I chose a different laser. So I'm going to be doing that. So the one example of an optical experiment is a recent experiment at the Poros Laser Facility. So this is the Center for Relativistic Laser Science in Gwangju in South Korea. So this is kind of a typical setup. You have your main laser beam collides with a gas jet or a gas cell to ionize particles to liberate electrons, which are then accelerated by there's a rate of acceleration. Apart from that main beam is then peeled off and refocused to an interaction point after the acceleration. And so here, this is the colliding laser. This is the time laser that was on the previous slide. And you have the electron beam coming in, and this is, in this case, they measured nonlinear quantum scattering. So they image the electron beam downstream using Lanex screens, and they separate the products of the reaction using magnets. And later, for the photons, they use an ISO screen, which is a bit like acting like a color in it. This is an example of a laser wave field accelerated spectrum. So typically, it has a narrow peak at energies of a few GeV, which is obviously very, very good. The problem is there's quite a tail here. So if you want to do anything with precision, with laser wave field accelerated beam, it's quite, you have to take into account the fact that you've got this long tail and that's not just a narrow loss force. The advantage of using laser wave field acceleration is that you can do acceleration on a very small scale. So you don't save any Linux. So the acceleration gradients are very high. But the shot-to-shot reproducibility is quite poor in general, although it's getting better. So if you want to build up statistics with collisions, it's difficult. Instead, simply you choose collisions where the electron beam and the laser have overlapped really well, and then you analyze this. So the Corals experiment then, they measure the photon spectrum, so that's kind of the idea. So there's good agreement with prediction from QED, just by way of referring to the parameters. So the intensity parameter is the number 10. And the strong field QED parameter is not 1, but it's 0.1, 0.3. I think the best that they got is about 0.4. So there's good agreement of the spectrum. Down the tail, the agreement gets a little bit more difficult to see. This is some parameter space for different experiments among the Compton scattering. In the horizontal axis, we've got the intensity parameter. So that's the charge field of photon. The try equal to 1, so the strong field parameter equal to 1 is the diagonal line, and we get to higher strong field effects as we get over here. The vertical axis is the energy parameter, so it's to do with the center mass energy. It's only of the order of about 0.1, 0.01 for these experiments. So you've got these series of experiments that have been performed for the lasers, where you're going to higher and higher non-linearity, so it's charged with photon. And then various experiments various states are being commissioned or being built, which will really push this to much higher values of this intensity. So really look at really highly nonlinear interactions at the background. In contrast, we'll talk about these experiments here. So these experiments here start at the problem from the other side. They don't start with high power laser, so they start with VAC. And then they use a moderate laser in order to measure some of the effects. So these are open from the Slack, and Luxi's proposed that data, and I'll talk a bit more about Luxi in a second. So They have the advantage that they can get to higher energy, but the strength of the laser is less, so they can't probe this non-linear function as much. But I'm going to make the argument that that's fine. Also, because they're using a LINAC, they've got a narrowband source of electrons, so they can. The reproducibility of collisions is good, so you can build statistics in these effects. Just by way of interest, this kind of overlap between particle physics and laser physics, I think, is something that's attracting more and more people. Last year, we participated in this exercise run by CERN every 5 years to solicit inputs to the European Strategy of Particle Physics. And we run four strong for QED, so just an example of heads of groups in different places in Europe, and we had some guest authors from outside of Europe at some of these high-power laser facilities that have contributed to that. So there's not laser physics is not quite as established as particle physics. Obviously, lasers were invented much later than colliders, but it's slowly starting to consolidate, I think, into larger and larger groups. So I want to talk about this Lipps experiment because I think it's maybe more interesting from the particle physics side, but also UK is quite well represented. So LUPSI stands for Laser Unpacked Cell Experiment, and it's planned to run at DAISY. Collaboration around 100 people, open institutions. From the UK, we've got QUB, UCL Manchester, and Plymouth. And the idea here is to use the electron beam that drives the EUXFEL, so that's a 16.5 GeV electron beam, and to collide it with a laser. Lipps currently has a 40 terawatt laser, but plans to have a petawatt laser before the end of the decade. And it's a similar kind of setup to what we saw in the Carlos experiment. Downstream, you have magnets for separating parts of the reaction and separate them from the high energy particles. I'll give you an example of what I think particle physics can bring to this field. And that's demonstrated by this plot of the photon spectrum from the Carlos schedule. By having a LINAC guiding this, we have much narrower energy spread in our probe beam, which means that we can measure what's happening in our scattered photon spectrum to a higher precision just by building statistics, but also by knowing what's the nature of the collision. Here's an example. So this is a log plot of the number of photons produced per bunch crossing of the electron beam and the laser at LUPSI. These are different intensity parameters. What we see is for excited orbit one, we see a harmonic edge here. This is due to the edge of the first harmonic interaction with the laser. As we increase the intensity, this harmonic edge gets washed out and gets redshifted. Now, at lower values of excited orbit one, we see a very strong signal. By having a higher precision probe beam, we can measure the position of this edge, which gives much better access to what's going on in the physics than just total yields. The position of this Compton edge, as it's called, is given by this formula. This is basically just a fraction of the photon energy by the electron energy. So 16.5 GeV was the electron energy, so here it's around 3 GeV. Eta is this energy parameter, it's not so important as that point too. Interesting thing is where the intensity occurs. Remember, the psi parameter is the charge field cut. We can compare this with linear QED. With linear QED, we factor out position for harmonic energies. That's just given by Klein-Meschiner formula. That's a standard QED textbook calculation. The presence of the laser is introducing these non-linear corrections. As we increase the intensity parameter, we're picking up non-linear interaction with the laser at higher and higher order. So wave size of order one, then we can't truncate this series anymore. And instead, we have to include this interaction to all orders. So measuring the position of this edge as we change the intensity gives us an experimental probe into this all-order interaction predicted by our field theory and the interaction between the electrons and the laser. We could instead say, oh, okay, let's not look at the prediction of QED, let's look at the prediction of classical electrodynamics. So that'll be non-linear Thomson scattering. And again, we can see prediction for where this harmonic edge is and how it changes as we change the intensity. So it's a leading order, which is that here. I factorize out a factor of H bar from this eta parameter to show that as we change the intensity, we're picking up factors of H bar. We're becoming more and more quantum, if you like. And so one of the things about this field is people really care about the difference between classical and quantum physics. So as you change intensity, you're picking up more and more quantum corrections. And so you can plot where the quantum edge is as you change it, what the energy is, as a function of psi. If psi is too small, it's really, really small, it's just linear QED. If psi is too large, as we can see, psi goes to dominate the S. If psi is too large, it's just non-linear classical physics. The interesting thing is happening around psi order one. That's happening around here, where we can differentiate the strong fields QED prediction from standard linear QED. So you know, my message for stuff like this is we really want higher precision over power. It's great to have really powerful lens facilities, but using methods of particle physics, higher precision, building up statistics allows us to actually have a much better probe of predictions of theory. So we don't just want to measure electron laser collisions, we also want to measure photon laser collisions. So we generate a photon beam neutralizing an electron beam of a solid target, boost Rennstrahlung photons, or we can also peel off part of the laser to have a quantum scattered source of photons, which has the advantage that we have quite a high polarization grade, which allows us to do more studies of the theory, albeit at the cost that we have much lower energy. We're also considering using a crystal radiator, sort of a structured target, essentially using coherent Bremsstrahlung, gives us kind of narrow bandish source of photons, cheaper than the ICS source. So what's the signal for photon laser collision? So we've seen already is pair creation. So the thing about this process of pair creation is if you take a single laser photon and you take the high energy photons that we produce from that source, the center mass energy is too low to create a pair. You have to consider quite a large number of laser photons before you get to the threshold where you can create a pair. So if it looks like that happens to be 11 photons. That means that a perturbative signal, leading order LED signal, scales with size of power 23. Changing psi, the yield of pairs of photons we collide with the laser, if we just had linear QED, not linear QED, but leading order QED, would be this curve here. But as we increase psi, we have to include higher and higher orders, because obviously this is a series of size of order one, we have to include all orders. And the result of that is that it's actually sort of a suppression of pair creation. And this curve here, and this turning of the curve away from the perturbative but highly nonlinear prediction is our signal of this all-order interaction between the charge and the background. Albeit now, pair creation, which is a fully quantum process, whereas normally a quantum has a classical model. Okay, so these are just leading order processes. We also want to look at higher order processes. For example, Compton showers, you can imagine your electron being collided with a laser and you can get more than one photon. Now, something's a bit different in interaction with laser pulses than with particle beams. In particle beams, if you have two energetic beams colliding on the rest frame of one beam, it looks like the other beam is relativistically pancaked, right? The longitudinal direction it gets relativistically contracted. But here, we don't have a particle beam that we're colliding against a focused laser pulse, which doesn't relativistically contract. So the consequence of that is that the longitudinal scale of the laser pulse allows for much higher orders of emission. And so if you consider a higher order process like this, the propagator has a virtual parts and real parts. Just by an uncertainty relation, the virtual part can't propagate very far. So that means that higher order processes like this are dominated by the propagator going real. So here, for example, an electron emitting a photon, then becoming real and propagating like an orbital electron, emitting the photon, etc. This is kind of a standard approximation that we use to calculate like higher order processes. So here's just an example of from simulation. This is for AGB electrons of cylinder, or we could have it a bit lower than what energy what we have at Luxie. And this is using the Ptarmigan open source simulation code, which has been developed by Tom Blackburn at the University of Gothenburg. So what we see is psi of two, and a naught used by different groups of people doing the same thing. Psi of two for our electrons on average, the most expected thing to happen is that they don't make any photons when they collide with the laser beam. As we increase psi, so for example, 7.5, it's most likely that each electron emits on average two photons. So even though the second order process here is more probable than the leading order process, it's still perturbed to be sort of complicated. However, it's been known for a while that there's an exception to this. And this happens if we imagine that we have this strong field parameter, imagine we can make it really large. And what happens to these three-level processes, like monolith, Compton, monolith, Reitmuller, is that in the large kind limit, they scale as other QED postgames at 2/3. Now, this is significant because you can ask the question, well, what if we could reduce pi of order 1,000? We saw proposals for doing that already in the lab. What would that mean about this QED fraction? Well, if I were of order 1,000, other countries as order 1, what that means is that this kind of perturbative series here is not something that we could truncate. We couldn't have this situation where we could just say, oh, we just stop our 6 factors or whatever. Instead, if we had such an intense background chi was so large, that would mean we'd have to include all orders of interaction, not just with the laser, but also all orders of emission. And so some people say that QED can become strongly coupled when we have such an intense field. Now, it's not just the tree-level diagrams, it's also loops. So, polarization operator and the electron mass operator go like alpha chi 2/3. Typically, in calculations, we don't really include radiative corrections because, as we saw, things are dominated by things being real. So, if we had alpha chi 2/3, not only would we have to include them, but again, we'd have to include loops for all of this. There's a nice series of papers in the 70s and 80s where they calculated loops of higher order. It was mainly done by Rutas and Rajni. And they got all the way up to three loop. And they found that the divergence with chi is strongest for chains of polarization operators, so called bubble diagrams. And so there's a conjecture called the Rutas and Rajni conjecture that if we have a very intense field, so if the field is locally constant and it's plane wave in nature, the true expansion parameter of QD isn't alpha QD, but it's alpha chi 2/3. Okay, so just to kind of underline that fact, because I think it's kind of interesting, maybe not so well known. Instead of QD, we've got a process with n vertices that goes like alpha QD to the power n is the probability. To get a more and more accurate test, we include radiative corrections, so loops are high about alpha. And this perturbative series is the thing that's been tested really well when people say that QD is the best test. Fundamental theory of nature. So things like G minus 2 experiments. What I've mainly been talking about is when we have an intense laser pulse, these functions now become functions of the intensity parameter, and as the load is made more intense, this shifts the importance of those parameters. Typically, it's only that the leading process that's going to be dominant. What we're saying now with this recent conjecture is in a high power regime. We don't know what, but we can't expand like this from radiative corrections. We have to include all orders of this. So we won't be able to write down. So I think it's quite compelling that there's a region of QED where we don't have to do calculations. So we really need input for experiment. That brings us to the final topic of radiation reaction. So radiation reaction is a very old topic, going all the way back to people like Lawrence and Abraham and Dirac. But it's a general question of what do you do when the field is so intense that the radiation affects the trajectory of your charges. So I'm going to talk about it classically first, and then talk a little bit about QED. So if I ask you to calculate the radiation produced by an electron when it collides with a laser, how do you do that? Well, in undergraduate, at some point we learn you can solve the Lorentz equation. This is the Lorentz equation I've written in a weird way with the potential. But we use that to get trajectory, and then using trajectory, that produces a current, which we use the wave equation to get radiation. But immediately we see a problem that to solve the first line for the trajectory, we need to know the radiation, to solve the radiation in the trajectory. So typically, you can actually solve this coupled set of higher order non-linear groups. But what do we learn in undergraduate physics? Or we do it perturbable. Suppose we use the potential gain to two parts, the intense part is the laser and the radiation field, which is classically as well. The laser interaction isn't E, so this factor of E is being absorbed there, in case you think I've forgotten the factor of E there. Then you approach the conservatory, you say, oh, the lake's really intense, the radiation's going weak. So, we put the laser into the Lorentz equation, solve for the trajectory of the electron and laser, and then we use that trajectory in the wave equation to calculate what radiation the electron produces.
But now imagine that it's elevating in 5 minutes, so it just rolls over.
I was too confused with my computer, and that's going to be upside down. Yeah. But I'm sure it's really fair. Okay, thanks for the explanation. So, so imagine we do that fine, but imagine now that the radiation produced is intense, or there's a lot of it, or this interaction happens for a very long time. Then you need to go to higher order. So you need to take that radiated field and then you need to plug it back into the equation of motion for the Lorentz equation and you need to solve for the new trajectory, take into account the fact that the radiated field has effects on the trajectory of the electron. So you solve that for the new trajectory and then you put that into your weight equation and get a benefit of correction for the radiation. And you continue doing this until you have a tower of equations. And if this effect was very strong, we have to include all of these and resum them. Now, I'm not going to go through that. If you do that resummation procedure, you end up with something called the Lorentz-Abraham-Dirac equation. And it's easier to talk about an approximation for that we use to describe what happens with electrons colliding with lasers called the Lambert-Vicious equation. So here we have the Lorentz equation gain, written F by mu. And this is the part that's classical radiation reactor. So we see it's non-linear in the laser field, it's the background field, and it's not within the velocity of the electron. And it's got our radiation reaction parameter, E squared over C. Okay, so we solve this in closed form, not always, but we can solve in a plane wave background, and that's great because we want to look at lasers. And one of the predictions of that is the following. If you calculate the momentum of the electron after it scatters with the laser, the plane wave, as a fraction of the incoming momentum. If it's a plane wave, that ratio is exactly one. That's the Lawson-Woodward theorem. Plane waves can't accelerate electrons. But if you include radiation reaction, that's not the case. And so it's radiation reaction parameter here, which depends in a non-linear way on the intensity of the plate. Okay, so that's the classical case, but we're obviously interested in QED. Quantum radiation reactions is a general question about what happens. It's not because in QED, obviously, we don't emit photons, that's going to create pairs, maybe there are loops. It's a much broader question in general. However, you can make a connection between QED and classical prediction by calculating things to leading order in the radiated field. And what diagrams are important? Well, of course, constant scattering, you know, electron goes in, emits a photon. You know, recoil on the electron, that's clearly an effect of radiation reaction. But also, in order to recover the classical prediction, you need to include loops. So it's kind of interesting that loops we associate with quantum stuff, but actually that's the limit we've got loops. So loops are really important in order to get classical prediction. So we understand how to calculate at least to leading order in QED, but the general problem is unsolved. So there were several experiments like Gemini, not far from here, very successful, that showed a method of radiation reaction, and a recent paper showing that there's that can differentiate the QED radiation reaction from classical radiation reactions. But I think that we can do better, and one example of where we might be able to do better is in the following setup. So that's the Clarex accelerator and Daresbury. You have a 250 MeV Linac. So again, as I've been trying to extol the virtues of Linac and the properties of electron beams in this talk, this is an average energy spread of around 1%. And it's also a high power optical laser in Daresbury, which can reach high values around 10, deep in the nonlinear regime. The strong field parameter is small, but the radiation reaction parameter is the order of a few percent. And the claim here is that by using the precision that you get from combining methods from particle physics and accelerator physics with laser physics, we can find signals of radiation reaction, not in the total yield, but in the spectrum. I'll give some examples of simulations that we perform. So this is an example of what happens to the electron beam energies after the collision. So there's no radiation reaction, 250 MeV, we get this purple dashed line here, nothing happens. If all the radiation reaction were classical, then what happens to this, the electron beam energies, they all get shifted down, in this case by about 10 MeV. All the electrons interact with the laser classically and they all radiate continuously. Contrast that with the prediction from QED. Not seen, but the expectation value of this QED curve is about the same as classical, but the variance on the trading is very spread out with its tail. And that's because one of the features of radiation emission in QED is it's stochastic. So you could have an electron pass through the laser without missing once, in a phenomenon known as punching. Or it might, the electron in the quantum theory might get to higher regions of the intensity of the laser beam because it only emits stochastically than it does classically. That's called straggling. So we have quantum effects which contribute to potentially the spreading of the electron energy. Where does that spreading occur? So this is kind of transverse momentum distribution along the electric field direction of the laser. And you see that in the classical no radiation reaction case, there's no spreading, but in the quantum case there is. Two dimensions, let's go like this. So this, you can see obviously the amplitude goes down in the quantum case in the center for the spread in the transverse momentum distribution. So the idea would be to be able to measure what's happening in the tails. To differentiate quantum from classical radiation reaction unambiguously, you could also rotate the polarization plane of the laser, so tails should move around depending on the polarization plane. So there's a collaboration forming at the moment, obviously in difficult times, between particle physics, accelerator physics, and laser physics. So hopefully we'll have more to report on that in the future. I thought it was a nice demonstration of collaboration between particle physics and laser physics. Okay, so that's my summary. I will convince you that you can do some really nice things with fundamental physics on high power lasers. I only talked about QED because I think there's a lot of interesting things happening there. We can do things with lasers and electron beam processes and BSM, but I decided to focus on QED for this talk. The interaction between the charge and field, it's a non-perturbative prediction of quantum field theory, which we can test in experiment. We don't have many of those. Typically, non-perturbative predictions that we have require large colliders and are difficult to get at, but in the interaction between lasers and electrons, it should be easy to access. I think there's a kind of growing synergy between particle physics and laser physics, which is leading to new experimental prospects and definitely developments in simulation theory. And is this intriguing regime at high field parameters where QD appears to become strongly coupled? And we have no methods to calculate this at the moment, so we definitely need input from experiments. And I think that using precision, increasing precision, rather than going to a high laser power, is in order to do this. So thanks for your attention.
Thank you. That's really interesting. Has anybody got any questions?